Welcome everyone to our latest iteration of our Kollel Aharon Valeya series, graciously sponsored by Mark Zuckerberg or whoever decided to be the Kollel Aharon Valeya. So whoever our mysterious benefactors are, we wish them Yasher Koach. Thank you. And thank you to everyone for coming tonight as we are in the second Parsha of the year, Parshas Noach 5786, after the deluge. So let's look at the very first verse, the very first opening, the gambit of our Parsha. So in Hebrew it says like this, Ela, these, toldos, are the generations or products of Noah. Noach, Ish Tzadik Tamim. He was this perfectly righteous man. Haya. He was Bidoro Sav in his generations. Esa Elokim Hisaleknach. Noach walked with God. Then the next verse, which is not here, goes on to say, Vayoled Noach Shoshavanim Eshem Etzchan V'Yosyapas. And by the way, Noah gave birth to three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafes. Now, if we were to judge Noah by his greatest legacy, the greatest, we are his greatest legacy. Every human being who walks the planet Earth is a product of Noah. You're either from Shem, Ham, or Yafet. Anyone, Jew or non-Jew, is a part of the B'nai Noah, the children of Noah. They're Noahide. In fact, there are people who aren't Jewish, who are righteous people, who have a whole sort of edict that they keep with the Noahide laws, the special commandments given to Noah and the world. And these people are righteous Gentiles, and we in Jewish tradition believe they go to heaven, like it's a good thing. So all of us are B'nai Noah. And yet, the Torah does not treat his three sons as the greatest tolda, the greatest product, his legacy. No. What was his legacy? That he was a good guy. That he was an ish sadiq tamim, that he was this holy, righteous person. So it's kind of an interesting thing that his tzidkas, his righteousness, was the greatest legacy of all. His ma'asim tovim. Now, why would that be? So on a simple level, on a non-chassidish pshat, drush, one would say, there used to be this great rabbi, Olav Shalom in Queens, Rabbi Rosenblatt, and he was a kassad of a little bit of a chassid, talmud of some great, great rabbis of Litva, but also he was chassidic. So he used to on Shabbos famously say, so that's the regular pshat, and now the chassidish pshat, and he'd give you something much more interesting, you know, much more hamish and much more geschmack. So the simple explanation would be like this. The simple explanation is that a person, the legacy we leave in children, is not eternal. Because children pass away. They don't live forever. But what is eternal are our deeds that we leave in this world. Our ultimate legacy that can never be taken away from a person. They accompany us literally into the Olam HaAmet, into the next world. Not the children. Again, don't get me wrong. We want the children to daven for us when we leave this world, to have progeny, 100%. We're not diminishing that. But beyond that, our greatest legacy is to be an ish tzadik tamim hayah, to be this wonderful, great individual, and then we are accompanied into the next world by our deeds. So it's a beautiful, beautiful concept that both are forms of eternity, but maybe the more enduring form of eternity would be one's actions. But there's something here that is a little strange, okay? Look at Rashi on number two. It says he was a tzaddik, but then it qualifies his righteousness. It doesn't just say he was a righteous guy. No. Bidorotav, in his generation. So Rashi brings a famous dispute between the rabbis. Okay, and here's the rabbis. Some of our sages, our rabbis, interpret it favorably. That how much more so if Noah had lived in a generation of other righteous people, he would have been even more righteous. We'll explain and unpackage this in a moment. But other rabbis interpret it derogatorily in a negative vein. In comparison with his generation, Noah was righteous. But if he had been in Abraham's generation, he would not have been considered of any import. But the words in Hebrew are much more dramatic. Ready? It says, lo shaveh klum. Basically, it's a good word in Yiddish. We were talking about Yiddish a moment ago. Garnished. Oy. He would have been a garnished, a nothing. Lo shaveh klum. Okay, this is harsh. Let's unpackage this. So again, sometimes in the Talmud, we have what they call outlier positions. The extreme on one side, the extreme on the other, and we try to find a middle ground. But the use of the outlier positions is very useful. Why? Because that shows you where you can go right or left and still remain within the confines of normal Jewish halacha, Jewish behavior, whatever. Okay? That is the purpose of having outliers, okay? So that we can confine our position within the confines of these extreme positions. Okay, but this is a little harsh. One rabbi says the following. Look, Noah was all alone. Oh, yeah, he had his family, but he didn't have any peers of any import. Now, his wife, Naama, was an incredibly righteous person who, ironically, was a progeny of Cain. Cain got to have his legacy, even though he basically was wiped out. Cain, right? Remember Cain and Abel, like the old joke? How long did Cain hate Hevel? How long did Cain hate? As long as he was able. Sorry. All right. But the bottom line is, other than his wife Naama and their three sons, and I guess the daughters-in-law, so there are eight of them, plus the giant Og is kind of lurking there on the ark. So there are nine kind of big individuals that survive. He didn't have any peers. So the first position is, look, a man or a woman without any chevra, if you don't have any peers to bounce things off and to role model things for you, then you're limited in what you could become. So kol shekein, if Noah had an Abraham and Isaac and a Jacob and other great pious people to model behavior for him, he would have been even greater. So that's extolling the virtue of Noah, saying, oh my gosh, you know, his righteousness was great, but it would have even been greater in a greater generation. It would have been elevated by the hashpa, by the influence of these wonderful tzaddikim. But the other rabbi really goes to a harsh, harsh approach. He says, you know, Noah, you basically are like, there's an expression that the man with one eye is a king among the blind. In other words, he's not such hot stuff. Relative to the wickedness, the reshut of the generation of the flood, Noah's hot stuff. But if Noah's alive in the time of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, and Aaron, etc., he would not have been noteworthy. But it doesn't say that he would not have been noteworthy. Garnished. What's going on? That's a harsh, very extreme position. So let me share with you a thought and then even a defense of the Noah position. Ready? So here's a thought. The fact that one rabbi says he was lo shaveh klum, he just was nothing, a garnish. He's not saying that Noah literally was righteous to no extent at all. He's saying the following. You can't judge Abraham and Noah on the same scale. It's judging Major League Baseball and the triple A's. The whole talent level, the whole righteousness, it's a different scale. So the Abrahamic scale, the Isaac scale, it's off the charts. It's not, Noah doesn't even enter that class. He's not a major leaguer. So by his triple A standard, he's a good guy. But he's not even entering into the Abrahamic field of righteousness. That's an interesting way of looking at it, I think. But let's defend Noah's position, shall we? So it says directly in this Rashi that had he lived in the time of Abraham, mentions Abraham by name, right? Because Abraham shows up right at the end of Parshas Noah. He makes a nice little cameo appearance there at the end. He's sent by, you know, he goes with his dad, Terach, then they leave town. They don't quite make it to the promised land, but he's mentioned. So let's try to defend Noah's position. What have I told you? Stunningly, I love this medrash, that without Noah, there isn't Abraham. There's an obscure medrash, I saw it inside, in Queens, New York, many moons ago. I wanted to see it with my own eyes because it was kind of shocking to me. Here's what the medrash says. And by the way, somebody mentioned on Shabbos, I think Dr. Fireworker, how there's these incredible charts in the stone art scroll Chumash in the Bible. One of them that he loved is this chart of the of generations between Adam, Noah, and that connect you all the way to Abraham. And he was stunned to learn, because it's true, Noah lived so long because he was an antediluvian. I had to throw that in there. Every year I only get to mention the word antediluvian one parsha a year. Before the deluge, an antediluvian. Okay, so Noah being an antediluvian was not limited in his lifespan. Post-diluvians had limitations, yeah? Okay. Noah was alive at the same time that Abraham was alive. There was an overlap. So the Medrash says the following. It's amazing. When Abraham was a young man, he spent Shabbos. He spent Shabbat at the home of Noah and his son Shem. Remember, Shem, who became known as Melchizedek, was one of the greatest people in the world. He's our great-grandfather also, Shem. So Shem hosted a young Abraham. And one Shabbos, probably at Shalashidus, I'm guessing, I'm just projecting, they're having a little discussion about the history of the world. I mean, if I'm Abraham, I want to know. You are on the ark? Really? Like, really? I want to know. Okay. What happened to that raven? Did they wind up in Baltimore? Sorry, that was for Hadassah.
Yes.
No. Sorry about that. Hadassah's like, no, they didn't really there. They were really in Cleveland the whole time, right, Hadassah?
Yes.
Yeah, that's not the real team. That was an NFL shout out, by the way, for a very specific crowd that a very big Cleveland Browns fans. Right?
Absolutely.
By the way, Hadassah. Yeah. Noah was told never to let the raven back on the ark because he knew they would betray your Browns. Okay, just letting you know. God saw all. Okay, so what happens? Noah, who I guess is so old that he's not such a big conversationalist anymore, but Shem is there, and Noah probably is, you know, having his shalashidus, his exile in Tuna, and they're enjoying shalashidus. So Abraham says, why did you guys survive the flood? Everyone else is wiped out, but you guys survived. Why? What was your schus? What was the merit? Listen to this. Hachnasas orchim. We hosted guests.
Who?
So Abraham says to Shem and to Noah, Hachnasas orchim. You survived because you had hospitality? And he started to count, you know. Well, there's Noah. There's Naama, his wife, and there's Shem, Ham, Yapes, and then their wives. Who did you host? You're in the middle of a deluge. He says, no, the animals. We took care of them, Yom and Valayla, 24/7. We had to get up all the animals at different schedules and different types of food that we had to take care of and everything else. It was an amazing Hachnasas Orchim. We hosted these animals in the ark for a year. Abraham heard this, and he took it in internally, and it inspired him. And it says in that medrash, this was the inspirational moment of Abraham's life, where he mentally moved already to the south of Israel and opened up his Holiday Inn, his Eshel, his famous Holiday Inn that he and Sarah opened up to host everyone in the world for Hachnasas Orchim. So in other words, it was the inspiration of Noah over a meal that somehow made Abraham become the full Abraham expression. So yes, it's true that had Noah had an Abraham, he would have been a greater tzaddik. But it's also a legitimate truth to say, perhaps, based on this oral tradition, that without Noah and Shem modeling a certain type of behavior for Abraham, Abraham maybe would not have fulfilled his full potentiality for who he became. In other words, Abraham is the role model of Gemilas Chasadim. He's the ultimate expression of kindness to strangers. Nobody surpassed Abraham and Sarah, but it all came from Noah, Shem, which is an incredible thing. So maybe this Rashi is sort of bringing out the name of Abraham to make this comparison. So we all look at it in a derogatory way, and we say, oh, that Abraham was so great that Noah was a great. And that may be true in a purely objective truth. That's objectively true. Noah was not Abraham. That's true. But on the other hand, Noah, based on this chazal, on this medrash that I pointed out, he inspired Abraham to become Abraham. So there is this mirror effect between the two, which is an amazing thing. You don't have to be on the level of someone else righteously to sort of be inspired by somebody else. Somebody of a limited type of persona, their persona or their personality and their deeds, they could be a little bit limited. But you know what? Within the confines of that limitation, there might be something virtuous that no matter how great you are, you're never beyond being inspired by others' actions. And it could be something noble on a very small scale that extends that virtue to you and me, and we can be inspired. So a lot of things that can inspire us. I think it's a very nice little takeaway. Okay, let's go, please, to number three. These three, Shem, Cham, and Yafet, were the sons of Noah, and from these three young men, and who became very old men, I might add, the entire earth spread out. From these, the Iyei HaGoyim, the islands of nations, separated in their lands, each one to his language, according to their families, in their nations. Now, just a couple things. First of all, you hear the word goy a lot. The word goy is kind of like the word Jew. It's not a derogatory word at all. We are goyim because we're a nation, a goy kadosh, a holy nation. So it's like the word Jew, right? Somebody could say to you, oh, are you Jewish? And you would say proudly, yeah, Baruch Hashem, thank God. If somebody looks at you with their voice and that little sarcasm, you're a Jew? Whole different connection. You might get a little offended. Same thing with the word goy. If somebody says, oh, well, we're all goyim, that's not offensive. But if you look at someone not Jewish and say, hey, he's just a goy. Again, that's the Jew thing. That's not a nice thing to say. So it's interesting. What happened in the aftermath of the flood? Noah and his family were told, puruvu, be fruitful, multiply, proliferate, and fill up the world. Our world needs you back. Because again, this is like a second creation for our world, right? Because what was there before there was a world? There was mayim, right? We have mayim above, mayim below. There was water everywhere. So now, unfortunately, it's kind of like that Microsoft computer. I never use Apple because I don't want to give myself an eye in horror. Okay. So the Microsoft computer that, God forbid, you know, get that blue screen of death that becomes, God forbid, not jinxing anybody, but permanent blue screen of death. And you call up, you know, the Geek Squad and they say, there's something called a hard drive and you're going to bring it into me and we are going to purge the hard drive and we're going to reformat. Oy, vavoy. You know, you don't want to hear the word reformat. It's not a good thing for your computer. So God reformatted the world, and he used the same technique that he did originally, water. Water, water everywhere. So what happened to creation in the aftermath of the ark landing on Mount Ararat and wherever it was in Turkey, or wherever it was? Maybe that's why Erdogan doesn't like the Jews. Maybe there's something with the ark. I don't know. He's not a fan of the Jewish people of Israel. If you don't know who Erdogan is, good thing you don't know who he is. I'm deliberately probably mispronouncing his name to shtoch him. Okay, when there's a really bad guy, my wife will validate me. I take joy in not learning how to pronounce their name correctly, just so I can shtoch them a little bit. You know what a shtoch is? Like a needle. Okay, we're shtoching them. So the ark opens up and we open up and the world opens up. All the animals leave and they proliferate. Now what's amazing is it says there's this island mentality. Now, how do you associate an island? Think about it. When you have an open space of the world, creatures, big and small, great and tiny alike, they have a whole world to fill up and proliferate. So you don't get such incredible, weird genetics coming. But if you want to go to the singularly most unusual little island in the world, and it happens specifically because it's an island, you may be familiar with Madagascar, for example. Okay, what creatures live on Madagascar? So if you're into some of the movies, you'll know they have some really neat, funky creatures. right? Yeah. That come only from Madagascar. Why is that? Because when you're in the confines of an island, your genetics can only be sort of, they're limited in their scope of what you can produce. So by definition, sometimes islands come up with the craziest creations in the world. So it's like right here, it's right in the verse, right in the pasuk, that there were the islands of nations. There was incredible proliferation of humanity in all its glory. Yet 70 primal languages and these 70 little families that kept proliferating, and everything was great. And everyone loved it except for one guy. One guy was very ticked off. His name was Nimrod. And he's a decidedly unhappy camper. You know why? Because he wants to be God and he wants to rule the world. So let's look at source 4. The famous Tower of Babylon.
Yeah.
Migdal Babel. Now, what is very curious about the next verses that we're going to read very quickly, okay, because you can read with me with your eyes much faster than I can read with my voice. You'll notice that the sin of mankind is not, even if it's recognizable, which it really isn't, if you can identify the sin, mazel tov. But if you can't, join the crowd. And what's worse is God's reaction seems to be so over the top, you're like, wait a minute, what's wrong? This should be a ma'ala. It should be something great. So let's look at what happened with the Tower of Babylon, okay? Now the entire earth was of one language in uniform words. Wow. Right? They spoke Esperanto, whatever it was called, that crazy language that they tried to foist on us as little children. And it came to pass when they traveled from the east that they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there, and they said one to another, come, let us make bricks and fire them thoroughly. So the bricks were for them stones, and the clay was for them for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heaven, and let us make ourselves a name, lest we be scattered upon the face of the entire earth. That's man. Now let's see the God angle. And the Lord descended to see the city and the tower that the sons of man had built. Listen to God's reaction. And Hashem, the Lord said, lo, they are one people, and they all have one language, and this is what they have commenced to do? Now, will it not be withheld from them all that they have planned to do? Come, let us descend and confuse their language, so that one will not understand the language of his companion. And the Lord scattered them from there upon the face of the entire earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, he, God, named it Babel, Babel. For there the Lord confused the language of the entire earth, and from there the Lord scattered them upon the face of the entire earth. What did they do wrong? Let me ask you. Isn't the greatest chaval that we are divided? The idea that you have achdut, unity, unity of purpose, unity in philosophy, uniform language. Wow, it's utopia. And yet God sees it as a nightmare vision. The end of creation itself. It's the Khurban. It's the ultimate destruction of mankind and our world. And it's like, what are you doing? You're destroying my world. But I don't understand. One language, uniform words, everything's great. They make bricks. Everything's perfect. They have a project. Let's build a tower. All right, so you probably heard that they bring that about, let us make war against God. And they're very arrogant, the human race, and they want to build this tower lest there be another flood. They'll be high enough that they won't be subject to God's whims. Okay, but that's not really a satisfactory answer for God's direct response. It seems almost like if he was a human, kibiyachol, it's like a visceral response. I can't allow this to go on, and if it does, it's a death knell for the very vision of Genesis, of Maisa Bereishit. What's going on?
Gopher Baker, though.
I'm sorry?
Gopher Baker.
Okay, right. So, but why? What did they do wrong? What's going on? So let me share with you a vision, okay? What is creation all about? So we saw what creation was when it first happened in source number 3. There was a proliferation of humanity, correct? There was individuals just proliferating and creating other individuals. There was Baskin and Robbins maxed out in terms of the human race. Right? There wasn't just vanilla and chocolate and strawberry. There were just like 1,000 flavors to choose from, and it was great. And all of a sudden, humanity got upset and worried, and this guy Nimrod came along, Now, the word Nimrod means a rebel. Merida means to rebel against God. And Nimrod is a historical figure who is also someone who tried to end humanity. Why? Because he was worried about the world sort of proliferating outside of his jurisdiction. He didn't want that. He wanted control. Like any great dictator, he wanted to be at the top of the food chain, and he organized the world into this valley of Shinar, and he focused them on a project, and that project became the be-all and end-all for all of humanity. And it dehumanized people. Now, what's interesting, I just want you to take a note of this because we'll come back here in a moment. It seems to talk about the bricks. Like, oh, they used to use stone, but then they had this big fiery oven and they created bricks. It seems to focus on the bricks. So it must be that somehow the bricks are a necessary component to understanding, unpackaging what the sin was all about. So let me ask you a question. What if everyone decided in Israel and the Jewish world that we would all accept Hashem, we would all be unified? It would be glorious. But what would not be glorious is if a bunch of people with guns showed up all over the world and put a gun to your head and said, uniform language, uniform philosophy. So when it's at the point of a gun, when it's coercion, it's no longer the same thing, is it? So the rabbis say that, yes, they had a safahat and devarim achadim. They were at one language and they had one philosophy, one outlook. But it was coercive. It was forced from above. Wow, then that's an entirely different entity. Nimrod was at the top of the food chain. And what scared him, and ironically, through him, through Nimrod's actions, his worst nightmare became reality, right? What was he scared of? Penafuts were going to be scattered over the world and continue this nonsense of islands and proliferation of humanity and individuality. We don't want that. No, we want uniformity. Now, let me ask you a question. What is not uniform ever? A rock, a stone. You're never going to find two stones in the entire world that are going to be exactly the same. It's impossible. They're just products of God's world and erosion and all the different circumstances. Every stone is an individual, just like all of us are individuals. So the first thing they did is they said, no more stones. No stones. We're going to make generic bricks. They're going to be the exact dimensions, one of another. And we're going to build the tower as a sign, as a siman of our unity. So once again, by jettisoning the stones that are God's creation, the individuality that is represented by a stone, by the Eben, and going for these bricks, it is a sign of generic conformity. We're going to be like those bricks. And when they started building the project, the tower, it rose up majestically. And what happened? Everybody was part of the project. But it got to the point where humanity was lost. Listen to this incredible midrash. The oral tradition teaches us that if a human being up on that scaffolding, that ladder, 86 stories up on the project of the tower, if they, God forbid, fell to their death, nobody even blinked. They didn't even mourn. Another individual component sent them on up. If a brick fell, we're behind. Production has slowed down, right? So for the brick, they mourned and lamented. The human being, not so much. That became the reality of this world. So it's almost like a dystopian world that Nimrod had created. So in other words, when we say Safahat Varim Achadim, it's an enforced type of one language, one philosophy. It's not by choice. So there was no human choice here. It was Nimrod's choice. So it sounds sort of like what Stalin, Yimach Shemo, and Lenin, you know, Mao Zedong, all the despots of the past all had that uniform. But you know what else they share? They share something with Nimrod. It's an incredible thing. This is how you know that the Soviet Empire, the evil empire, was evil. You know why? Because the rules never applied to the guys at the top of the food chain. In other words, oh, I'm going to wait in line 3 hours for my potatoes in Moscow. I'm never going to wait. They have dachas on the Red Sea. You know, Brezhnev and all these guys, they had limousines that took them everywhere. They had their own restaurants and menus that they could go to. They could vacation, not the ordinary citizens. Same thing with Nimrod. So if you look around and see a society where there's a Nimrodian figure at the top, whether his name's Nimrod or Pharaoh or Nebuchadnezzar, which, by the way, the Talmud identifies them as being from one family, more metaphorically than in reality. In other words, you call somebody, Pharaoh is a Ben Nimrod. Why? Because of his mindset. And Nebuchadnezzar ben Beno. Why? Because the Talmud's saying that these have the same hashkafah, the same outlook in life, that they're Nimrodian characters. And he, perfect name, because he's rebelling against the will of God and creation itself. So now we understand the sin of the Dor HaFlaga, of the generation of the dispersion, that the sin was an actual rebellion against the nature of creation itself. And how do I know that creation was meant to be individuation? That the greatness of the human being is not in our generic traits. That's great that we have certain things that connect us, but the individuality that each of us can achieve, this is the glory of creation. I can prove this. Look at source number 5, our final source for tonight. And God said on day 3, let the earth sprout vegetation, seed yielding herbs and fruit trees producing fruit according to its kind in which its seed is found on the earth. And it was so. And the earth gave forth vegetation, seed yielding herbs according to its kind, trees producing fruit in which its seed is found according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Let me unpackage this for you very quickly. I touched on this in a previous class. I won't bore you. But this is an incredible, incredible verse. God hardwires into creation codes. You call it teva. We call it nature. But that means that there's a nature, bederech teva, that nature behaves a certain way. So he ordered, he commanded, he coded, to use a computer term again. He coded nature with the following dictate. The world will be beautiful because you're going to have vegetation and trees and flowers. Beautiful. And he said to the trees, you shall be careful to not share genetics. Don't share tree DNA. So I want to have cherry trees distinct from an apple tree. And an apple tree has to be distinct from an etrog tree. And so on and so forth. But what about the jishayim? What about the grass? He just said to the grass, grow. But when they grew, did you notice something? You probably didn't, but it's there, so you'll review it. When the grass grew, it also didn't share DNA. It was distinct. So the grass grew separately from other grass, just like the trees grew separately from one another. Now, by trees, it's a necessity. Because of the root system, it's very hard for many trees to grow too close to each other. Masha enkein, but you don't see this by grass. Grass is like literally indistinguishable. I mean, unless you're like an expert, I tell you, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of species of grass, probably just here in Luzerne Valley. But when I see grass, I'm like you. Grass, mazel tov, I can't differentiate. But the grass made a fortiori argument, a kal v'chomer. And the grass said, what I'm saying to you didn't really happen, but it's like it happened. The grass said, no, wait a minute. Trees who have roots, by definition, grow apart and are easily recognizable by anybody. You don't have to be a rocket scientist or a botanist to identify this tree from that tree. Okay. But if God said to the trees, which by definition grow apart, be distinct and don't share your genetics. I want the cherries and the apples and the etrogs to remain apart. However much more so the vegetation, the grass said to itself, we, who are by definition grow all on top of each other, we're like weeds and grass. Nobody could differentiate between us. If it applies to the trees, it most certainly, kal v'chomer, if you have to say kal v'chomer, I'll explain it to you, but you need a thumb and you have to go like this in Talmudic literature, right? However much more so must we, the grass, grow apart and not share DNA. So how a fortiori argument works is very simple. If I say to you that when I was, and it works, by the way, it's by force. Mr. Yellen Esquire could tell us a fortiori argument, right? It's something you use in legal terms. It's a Latin term, by force. Here's a kal v'chomer. You ready? If I'll pick someone near and dear to my heart. Okay, if Wayne Gretzky, at age 22, who was in the power of his prime, 22-year-old kid, but he didn't have the skating ability to go get that puck before everybody else. Cal Vachomer, at age 39, in the last year of his career, he wasn't fast enough to go retrieve that puck. So that's like a logical argument, right? So here's the logical argument, that if the trees, which by definition grow apart, but God said in nature, he coded them, don't share your tree DNA, however much more so grass who grows on top of each other, we should not share. Now, what is this, the response by God? Do you want to hear the response of God? There's a beautiful prayer that you say every single day right before Ashrei. It's called Yehi Chavod Hashem Leolam Yismach Hashem B'Ma'asav. God rejoiced over his creation. Do you know when he rejoiced? On verse source number 5. When the plants, the vegetation, more specifically the grass, made this sort of, they're not thinking, grass are not sentient. I understand that. Okay. But the grass on its own, without God coding them, decided we're going to remain apart and distinct. Individual. God went, Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav. It worked. Creation worked. This is what Nimrod wanted to destroy. The individual. So it's very easy to understand now how the Tower Project and Nimrod's vision for uniformity and conformity would have undermined and destroyed creation itself, because the greatness of creation is that you have vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, little tutti frutti, little Mississippi mud. I'm just naming some of my flavors of Baskin Robbins. It's nice to have a plethora of individuals in our world. And that's the beauty and my blessing for all of us. Each of us has a unique mission in this world. And I'm not exaggerating. Think about it. We talked about a genetic project. Everyone here is the cumulative product of a genetic program that began in our parsha. Noah gave birth to Shem, Ham, and Yafet. They're not with us. I mean, they're almost with us still. They lived a long time. I'm joking. But Noah, Shem, Ham, and Yafet aren't with us. But we're their great, great, great grandchildren. We're the ultimate expression of hundreds and hundreds of generations and years of this genetic project that culminates in us. So we are the walking, breathing dreams and hopes of every previous generation. And we've all been given distinct DNA that is yours and yours alone. And each of you has shlichut. You have a mission that is yours and yours alone, right? You're like, you know, you're like the James Bond character or the Mission Impossible guy. This is your mission. No one else can fulfill your mission. You're unique. The greatest way that we can honor Hashem, and I'm going to say something that sounds heretical, but it's not. Ready? Listen very carefully. It sounds like kfirah, it sounds like heresy, but it's really the most incredible thing. Listen to this. There's one thing that God can't do for himself. Ooh, everyone's like, this really sounds heretical. But it's not. Listen, listen. God can't make you and me, you and me. If God coded you to be you, then you didn't become you. He made you. You're a robot. You're a computer program, right? So by you becoming you fully, by fulfilling the potentiality of that genetic program without God's intervention, without the necessity, like with the trees and the grass, he didn't have to code the grass. They did it on their own. If you do it on your own, and if you become yourself, the full expression of the hopes and dreams of every ancestor you ever had, going back to Adam and Eve, if we will fulfill that potentiality, you're giving God the greatest gift of all. And that is why he's Yismach b'ma'asav. He will cheer and applaud and rejoice at you becoming you. So the greatest gift, my bracha for each and every one of us, we should continue our mission, realize the beauty of your individuality, that you are literally irreplaceable. You're one, the only one. That's why there's an expression. You have to believe every day, Bishvili nivra ha'olam. Because of me, the world was created. It's not a selfish thing. It's true. Because of me, the world was created. And if you will look at the world that way, that you are that gift, that you can give to God what he can't do for himself, Yismach Hashem v'masav. May we give God tremendous joy and simcha in this new year. Thank you.